Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to head office of the Socialist Party. Comrade Adam Buick is going to speak on, have you read Piketty? Adam?
Yeah, well, that's the first question. How do you pronounce his name? Is it Piketty like rickety, or is it Piketty like spaghetti? But in actual fact, he's French, so it is. He's not Thomas Piketty, he's Thomas Piketty. But the trouble is that if you're an English person, you're not supposed to pronounce foreign names correctly, otherwise people will think you're being pretentious. So I should say, well, I don't know actually, because I was listening to something on the internet, talked by him, and the people introducing him did call him Piketty. But there was one person there who actually managed to go through the whole talk and not call him Piketty, but call him Piketty. Well, so I might try occasionally to pronounce his name as it would be correctly in French. Now, you know, the title is Have You Read Piketty? And he's the author of this book. He's a French economist, author of this book, Capital in the 21st Century, that was published in France last year, and it's been translated into English and published in March this year. And according to the world, it's everywhere. This is a copy of the Big Issue North. Are You Doubting Thomas? Piketty, that is. So there are people on the streets of northern towns, you know, selling this. And it's, well, I'll just read here. You'll see why people have been talking about it. It's a publishing sensation that has been billed as 50 Shades of Complex Economic Theory. Capital in the 21st Century, a 685-page doorstopper by Thomas Piketty. It sold over 200,000 copies and reached number one on Amazon's bestseller list. And then it says, multiple publications have dubbed the 42-year-old left-wing professor from Paris a rock star economist. So everybody has at least said that they have read Piketty. Actually, it's quite easily written, and it's easy to read. I mean, it's 700 pages, it's only 200 books of 350 pages, and it's, you know, unusually for a French intellectual, he writes simply, and the translation is a quite good one. Anyway, to come to the theme of the book, I mean, the basic theme is that capitalism left of itself, that the natural tendency of capitalism is for the rich to get richer, not just in absolute terms, but also in terms of in relation to the rest of the population. So it was first published in America in March this year, and when it was, it caused a bit of a sensation because it went against what had been the prevailing economic orthodoxy there for ages, the so-called trickle-down theory that the rich getting richer benefits everybody. Some of the wealth of the rich trickles down to the rest of the population. And also provided a theoretical justification for government intervention to try to counter capitalism's natural tendency towards greater equality, to try to counter it by... I'm doing it because it's French, that's why I'm moving my hands around. I say it provided a theoretical justification for government intervention to try to counter this natural tendency of capitalism towards greater inequality by means of increased taxation of the rich. So it was welcomed by left-wingers and other reformists. Now it provides solid evidence about the inequality of wealth ownership and income over the past 200 or so years. I mean, Piketty and other economists have been working on this, collecting statistics and data on inequality of wealth, inequality of income, well, mainly in America, but also in France and Britain, Sweden and Germany, and well, other countries, India, Argentina, and places like that. So it's the evidence is all there. In fact, it's divided into four parts. I mean, the first part is the theoretical part, which I'm not going to explain to you, but you can see what it is. The first law of capitalism, alpha equals r times beta, and so on. But I mean, I'm not going to do that, but that's the first part, which explains the theoretical background. And the second part is the introduction to these concepts in more simpler terms. And the third part, which is the part which is interesting from a socialist point of view, is called the structure of inequality. And that's where he produces all these statistics about how inequality has changed in the various countries in the world over the past 200 years. There's also a fourth part where he outlines practical reform process to try and do this, which is in fact the weakest part of the book. Now what these statistics and figures show is that inequality of wealth ownership increased throughout the 19th century and up until the outbreak of the First World War. And in the following 50 to 60 years, it decreased, and that from the 1980s to today, it has been increasing again. Now, he argues that if nothing is done about this, eventually inequality in the 21st century will reach the 1910 levels again, which in fact was in Britain and France, the top 1% of the population owned 70% of all wealth, and the top 10% owned 90%. So that's where he's saying things are going. Currently, by way of comparison, the top 1% in Britain own about 29%, and the top 10% own 70%. It's sort of quite a high degree of inequality, but it's not as high as it was in 1910. Now, the main reason for this reduction, says Piketty, is what he calls the rise of the patrimonial middle class. Now, the patrimonial middle class isn't, in fact, a class, and he doesn't claim it's a class. It's a statistical group. It's a group of people below the top 10% and above the bottom 50%. So it's the middle 40%. Now, during the course of the last century, you know, they acquired collectively as a group enough wealth, mainly in the form of a house, to reduce the share of the top 10%. Now, including houses brings out the inadequacy from a socialist point of view of what is being measured, because it's figures for the distribution of all forms of wealth rather than just of income producing assets. It's all right. So they're saying that the figures that have been studied are the figures for the distribution of ownership of all forms of wealth, including houses, and not just of income-producing assets, or capital, if you like. So it also includes personal possessions, such as houses, which don't yield an income. Now, the figures that we'd be more interested in, of course, would be the ones for the ownership of capital, the ownership of income-yielding assets. I mean, this would be much more unequal than the figures he gives, but they're harder to obtain. And in any event, they don't figure in Piketty's statistics. Now, it's important to realise, come back to the increasing share of the middle 40%, which has reduced the share of the top 10%. I mean, this hasn't been at the expense of the wealth of the top 10%. It's the amount of it's still gone up, but it's the percentage share that has gone down. Now, so what is the theory that Piketty derives from the facts that he presents? Well, he employs two basic concepts. I'm not going to go through all those, but I mean this one, R and G. That's the only thing I'm going to mention. Now, R is income, which is notional income as well as real income, which accrues to all forms of property, not just capital, but land and houses. So it's not the same as the rate of profit, but it's about wider and lower. Now, G is the growth of production as measured by GDP, but also it takes into account population growth. So it's the growth of gross domestic product per head of population. Now, what Piketty is arguing, what Piketty is saying, is that where the rate of income from property is greater than the growth of GDP per head, then inequality of ownership will grow. And at one point, he describes this, R is greater than G, as the fundamental structural contradiction of capitalism. Now, his point is that capitalism will tend, normal capitalism, under capitalism, R will tend to be greater than G, so that the natural tendency of unregulated capitalism is for the inequality of wealth ownership to grow. Now, he explains the growth of inequality in the 19th century and up to the First World War as being the result of R exceeding G during this period, and the fall in inequality between 1920 and the 1970s by R not exceeding G. And this was due to capital being destroyed in two world wars and needing to be replaced, so there had to be more production, there would be more growth of GDP, but also because much of the property in government bonds was devalued or destroyed through inflation, so that there was less capital to produce art. So in fact he says at one point that most of the wealth that had been accumulated up to the First World War was in fact destroyed in the First World War, you know, physically destroyed, so that that sort of paved the way for the next 50 or so years. Now, what is interesting about this explanation as to why there was a decrease in inequality of wealth ownership in the period 1920-1970 is that it's the period up to the First World War that's a normal function of capitalism, and this particular period from 1920 to 1970 when this didn't happen, it's the exception. So, you know, people are talking today about what's happening as the new normal, but in fact it's the old normal coming back. Now, this is hence Piketty's conclusion that without the exceptional circumstances of this period, capitalism's natural tendency is going to resume, and that in the 21st century the rich are going to get richer. So not just in absolute terms, but relative to the rest of the population as well, and unless, he adds, something is done to stop it. So, I mean, since he's not against capitalism, nor is he a socialist, though he is in fact a supporter of the French Socialist Party, so obviously he's not a socialist. But since he's not against capitalism, he's not a socialist, he thinks that something effective can be done about it within capitalism. And this is the last section of the book I mentioned, is by far the weakest section. Now, what he proposes is increasing the tax on the highest incomes, or part of the highest incomes, to 80% and a wealth tax. I mean, it's the sort of thing that the Labour Party once proposed, and which is why this book is so popular.
Well, she achieved it, they achieved it.
Hold on a second. Well, explain why it's happened before, but which is why this book is so popular in left-wing circles or reformist circles. But as he realises that capitalism is now more globalised than ever, he knows that the rich can move more easily their money from one country to another. For instance, out of a country which levied, or which was proposing to levy, a wealth tax. So he said what is needed is a global wealth tax. Now, the chances of this happening are even less likely than any country adopting such a penal tax rate on the rich on its own. In fact, they're as near as possible to zero. I mean, it doesn't explain who is going to impose, who's going to collect, who's going to enforce this global wealth tax. So it hints at things like the IMF or the World Bank or the Bank of International Settlements. So anyway, it's not going to happen. And so on his own theory, this means that in the 21st century, the rich are going to get richer in relation to the rest of the population. Inequality of ownership of wealth is going to grow. Now, this is not something that defenders of capitalism want to hear, and they've set out to discredit Piketty's figures. But generally, these figures have held up. What about the theory that he draws from these figures? I mean, has that held up? Doesn't hold up? Now, Marx said something similar. He said that the tendency under capitalism, in fact, he said this is what capitalism was for more and more capital to accumulate. Now, insofar as this was owned by individuals as their private property, they would get richer, at least in absolute terms. But this is a byproduct, if you like, of the impersonal process of capital accumulation. So it's the accumulation of capital, which is primary, and the rich getting richer follows under certain circumstances. Now, I think we can say, actually, under normal circumstances, insofar as the classic form of capitalism is where legal private property rights are vested in individuals. Now, you know, where this is the case, what Piketty and people like him are recording is the accumulation of property titles as distinct from the accumulation of capital. Now, this can be illustrated by pointing to the other form of capitalist appropriation that has existed historically, what existed in Russia from 1920 to 1990, state capitalism basically, where the means of production were vested in the state and where the state was monopolised by a minority who in effect collectively owned the means of wealth production and who shared out the surplus value in other ways. There was profit, interest and dividends, for instance. They had bloated salaries and they had various benefits in kind, you know, country dashes and special medical treatment, special access to shops. But there was still capital accumulation and there was still exploitation, but there wasn't any tendency for the members of this collectively owning state capitalist class to get richer. Now, one of the reasons why some of the critics of classical capitalism see state capitalism as better, not as worse, is that it would be a way of preventing the rich getting richer. I mean, as I say, there wouldn't be, if you establish complete state capitalism or something similar to what existed in Russia, there wouldn't be any tendency for the exploiters to get personally richer. In fact, much of the left-wing criticism of Piketty, I mean, since he's got critics on the left, mainly Leninists, as well as on the right, it's based on this, that his reformist approach via taxation is not the answer. Piketty's response is that state capitalism is incompatible with political democracy, which he rightly regards as something worth preserving. Now, these left-wing critics of him are right. I mean, penal taxation is not the answer, as this would be unenforceable and perhaps undermine the incentive to produce for profit. So I say state capitalism would deal with the issue of the rich getting richer, but would not end the exploitation of wage labour for surplus value that is built into capitalism. Nor is inequality, whether it's rising or not, the only thing that's wrong with capitalism. I mean, there are plenty of other things wrong with it. As is a system that puts and has to put profits before meeting human needs, it causes problems in all fields. I mean, just to mention a few, speed of work, ecological damage, and the rat race quality of life. But in any event, socialists are not interested in redistributing wealth in a more equal way. What we want is not a redistribution of wealth ownership, but the common ownership of the means of wealth production. And on this basis, these could be used to turn out what people need and that people would cooperate to produce what they need and then have access to the items of wealth according to the principle, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. I mean, that's socialism. And that's the socialist angle, if you like, on the distribution of wealth. We're not interested in equal distribution of wealth ownership. What we want is the common ownership of the means of wealth production. You are?
Thank you, Adam. Okay, before we go to questions and discussion, just to let you know, the next talk at head office will be on the 23rd of November. Comrade Darrell Whitehead will be speaking on the case against fracking. Also, can I ask for a collection? We are in capitalism and we do need to raise funds to maintain this head office and put on said talks. So if I can put that around.
I'm a woman.
Thank you. Also, the autumn delegate meeting will be taking place at head office on the 25th of October. On 26th of October. The 26th of October, I believe, is a election campaign workshop. For any comrades who and visitors who wish to go, we've got a speaker in Oxford on the 23rd of October. Details are in the Social Standard. I think that's about it. So, any questions for Adam? Any comments? Kevin?
Yeah, could you explain some of the term patrimonial?
Thank you.
I don't know what it means, seriously.
Well, it comes from the word patrimony, which means that this is property, but like I said at the end, that is the personal property, you know, vested in individuals.
So you're not saying it's an enclave of men, a certain area that's taking all this money
then? No, what it is, it's certain people have got wealth as their personal possession. And if you've got a lot of it, it's a patrimony. You know what I mean? And I mean, he talks about the patrimonial middle class, which is the middle 40%. That is people that own some property. But they own a house, in fact. But
the reason I ask this, because patriarch, what might mean to do with patriarchal, that's the only reason I ask.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's the same word.
It comes from the French patrimoine, which means your assets, your net assets. But it originally came from the word, I guess, Latin, patrus, or whatever it was.
Must be something to do with patra, yeah.
Yeah, because at those times, obviously, in the 18th century, 19th century, it was the head of the family who obviously controlled the assets.
Okay. Well, I mean, that was the case, actually, wasn't it? Yeah. The men that owned the property of the whole family, including any property. Yeah. Why wives couldn't own property in the until the end of the 19th century?
And the rich in France now talk about gestion de patrimoine, which means the management of my assets. Mm. And they still use the term now to mean, you know, management of my wealth management.
Thanks very much for that. I've learned something.
Yeah, we sort of learned an awful lot. I'm learning.
Jacqueline?
When you talk of these people, this middle set, I mean, they're out there working for a salary, possibly a big salary, or is this people who do not have to go and get employed?
I don't know what you're saying, they. Looking around here, I think we can probably say we. Some of the people in this room, I mean, he doesn't claim it to be a class. He uses the word patrimonial middle class, but it's purely a statistical group. It's the people who are below the top 10% and above the bottom 50%. And it's quite easy, in fact, if you've got a house, you'll automatically be in that 40%. In fact, you don't even own a house. So but as you say, as far as we're concerned, they're still part of the class that have to go out and sell their ability to work for a wage or a salary. Part of the working class in the broad, proper sense of the term. He's just using the word patrimonial middle class to describe a section of the working class which has acquired some property, you know, and some savings, but not much. I mean, nothing compared with the top 1% and the top 5%. In fact, he actually says that the inequality of wealth within the top 10%. In the top 10% of wealth owners, most of the wealth is owned by the top 1%. So if you're between the 9th and the 10th, you know, you're not necessarily that well off.
Yeah. Jacqueline again.
So this would be the group now that is one salary packet away from coming exactly into the working class. And be realistic about those terms.
Well, I mean, if you are a member of the patrimonial middle class, if you've got a house and you become redundant and you haven't paid for it, yes, you will be in trouble.
Yeah, I am in that trouble.
Aren't
we all?
Not yet, anyway.
Do you want to speak?
No, I would like to say, but I'm not prepared to be so standing by the well of them. Of all this, the current life, and who this Frenchman is, what's his name, and who wrote the book.
Ah.
I want your copy of it.
There you are.
Is it in French?
No, it was in French.
Is it in English now?
Yeah, it's been since March, it's been in English.
Excellent.
But the relevance to it is that the third section, where he produces the figures on the distribution of ownership of wealth,
yeah.
They confirm what socialists say, that the basis of present-day society is the ownership of the means of wealth production by a minority of people.
Yeah.
Now, that's the relevance of this, but this bit here is interesting for professional economists, and the last part is not interesting to any, not relevant or not interesting, because, I mean, I've just been looking at this again, and it says here that Piketty's solution to this inequality is an 80% global wealth tax, a policy he admits is unlikely to happen. So he produces all the statistics and so on, and can only come up with a fiddling reform. Well, not a fiddling reform, a reform which is not going to happen. So,
He's sold a book and he's increased his personal wealth. So
I don't think he's quite as cynical as that. Danny?
I mean, he produced like the impossibilist position. That's it.
This book is exactly the version I was going to buy from the one by Marx. My body isn't dead.
Well, I think actually, I mean, there must be a reason why he called it Capital.
Oh, really?
Might see himself as a 21st century Marx, but
yeah.
I mean he does mention Marx in here, but he doesn't. I don't think he's read Marx
nature.
Properly.
He says it all, hasn't he?
Well, Jacqueline had around. He actually spoke. Danny, go on.
Yeah, you've spoken about what is seen in the present capitalist system as the normal legal way of accumulating wealth. I want to touch on money. What about the black market, the drug dealers, the pornography?
What about the underground?
Danny gives a very good talk on this one. They don't care where the money comes from. Surely this is impacting, possibly, or it isn't.
But, I mean, when I was listening to a talk he gave earlier this month in some American university, he gives an example of what happened in Russia and Eastern Europe. I mean, the oligarchs there and the capitalists there, they can't make the same sort of claim that, you know, the capitalists here can. I mean, they clearly didn't get that wealth from working hard. I mean, it was just, you know, stolen, if you like, from the state, or handed over to them, the state handed over to them and divided it up. So the rich, well, they can't have earned their wealth. They might have inherited it through the, you know, patrimony from or, like in Eastern Europe, they just grabbed it. And, you know, gangsters.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, but the Europeans did the same thing in Africa.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. If you go far enough back amongst the capitalists in this country, I mean, in the Sunday Times list of the top 100 people, I mean, half of them are aristocrats, and the other half are property developers.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
there's one or two sportsmen and pop stars, but I mean, you know, neither of those are ways that people got wealth from work. Anyway, even if they did get wealth from being an industrialist, it wasn't their work that made them wealthy.
Yeah, well, a question just come to mind, and I've got to come to that point. Does he mention war at all?
He did.
Yes.
He does.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's his explanation for why there was a decrease in inequality of wealth ownership after 1910. I mean, he's got graphs and it shows it reaches a peak in 1910.
Does he talk about the causes of war?
Not about the causes of war. He just says war happened, and it was war that destroyed capital and some of the wealth of the rich that accumulated in the First World War. And that this led to a period of this famous formula, which he thinks R didn't grow faster than G. In other words, the rate of return on capital didn't grow faster than the growth of production, because the destruction of the war was being reconstructed. You know, and I think that's quite an interesting argument, because what he's saying is that period was an exception, and the normal period of capitalism is what happened up in the 19th century right up until the First World War, and what he thinks is going to happen, or has been starting to happen already since 1980, and will continue throughout the 21st century. But the thing is, he is a reformist. He has this let out. But this is what happened with unregulated capitalism. But I mean, this is the last section of his book is actually called something to do with regulating capital in the 21st century. So he doesn't actually draw our impossibilist conclusion. He thinks that it can be reformed. It can be remedied, but in fact, since the solution he proposes is global wealth tax, which is not going to happen because nobody's going to impose it, he's in effect saying, this, on his own theory, that this is what's going to happen. Yeah. It's going to go back towards, unless it's another war, of course.
So, we've got a bloke here who accepts that wars are going to happen in capitalism. Right. And he's compiled all these figures. Yeah. And he's made a decent fist of. Well, he's a strange old cove, isn't he? Because he can't stretch his imagination further than just trying to reorganise the majority servitude. Yeah. That's basically what he's doing. There he is, he's staring him right in the face. He's done all the research, he picked up all the figures. Basically, what he's done, he's discovered a great aspect of our servitude, and he has no solution. It's like always accepted. Mm. Mm-hmm. And that's all we're good for.
Can I just defend him just a little bit? He has shown the capitalist standard bearers he's challenged one of their fundamental premises, which is that rising tide raises all boats.
Yeah.
So he's come up with some statistics, and he wouldn't have got the reaction from the Financial Times if he did, unless he had hit a very sore point, or a very sensitive point in the capitalist discourse. You know, how capitalism is projected as it is today by those obviously who are part of it. So he has come up with a very good argument.
So you've got to get a bit nice. That's basically what he did.
I wouldn't listen to his solution. I'm fascinated by the work he's come up with. He's done 10 years of statistics.
I appreciate that. Yeah. But his imagination can't go further than the reorganisation of our servitude.
The gentleman here wants to contribute, and Franklin, but this gentleman first, Frank.
I'd like to say thank you to the lady over there. I spoke to when I came in, because I'm in a position now where I need to determine where I became a socialist, and that was through book by people like George Orwell. I have other interesting things. This is the most fascinating experience I've had since I first went and was given a book. I can't remember. I was at the university and met the people who became the people like Thomas Piketty, who had been their student at Harvard, and people like a man called C.P. Kindleberger in the United States, who revolutionised economics. This is an experience on par with that. I just mentioned that one interesting book I've got is by Vladimir Ilyich on the development of capitalism in Russia prior to the revolution. That's a sort of thought like this book. I want to restore my self-confidence and value in myself by knowing and knowing how. So that's been wonderful today. Thank you.
That's fair enough. In fact, that book by Lenin, The Development of Capitalism in Russia, is quite a good book. It's pretty.
It's pretty
he didn't write part two, which is Developing Capitalism in Russia after 1917.
But somebody else has written one, which is who's written the sequel.
Well, we've written the sequel, our pamphlet on Russia.
But I want more than the pamphlet. I want who was the guy who became famous guy in the mortal in the Red Square, who did the second bit. Was it Stalin?
No.
Who was it?
It was us.
The Socialist
Party. Oh, no, I mean, your predecessor. I can see the brilliance of this.
Okay.
I will see it.
Yeah. Okay. We've got a comrade over here. Can you speak, Frank?
Wait, just on the Spina's reference to this book, but is it not a fact in this country, probably in America and France and other so-called advanced countries, that most of the working class don't work for, certainly not directly, for big companies. They work for small companies or medium-sized companies. I mean, family reference, I'm not a shareholder, but my brother, anybody knows Stockwell Motors down the road here?
Yeah.
Sort of very accessories. I mean, my brother and my father, learning the breeder, and my uncle, they started that. Going back about 50, 40 years ago, working in it, you know, really working hard. And the thing is, what I'm getting at is that a lot of workers work for these small companies or medium-sized companies. They're not all working for big. Look, I used to be in the engineering industry years ago, and the only big company I voted for, worked for actually, was when I was working in Liverpool for General Motors. But all the other companies I worked for, must have been half a dozen, I don't know, but often shop steward there, and that, were small and medium-sized companies. And I think it's true today. I don't think in any way invalidate the criticism of capitalism, but all workers not work for big companies, are they?
I didn't say they did, and they don't need it either.
I mean, they're not, in other words, if you give the impression that about a tiny minority of the super rich, which they are, there's a tiny minority. A lot of the workers are not working for them, are they?
Well, do you want to think about that?
They're not.
No.
Well, I mean, this has got to be recognised, isn't it? Surely.
I don't see how it's relevant to the argument. I mean, they're still. Well, I mean, the figures here are Britain at the present moment. The top 1% own 29% of wealth and probably a higher percentage of actual capital, the wealth that produces an income, and the top 10% own 70%. I mean, this is measuring patrimony, their portfolio, you know, the wealth that they've got. It's a separate issue from the size of the businesses they've invested their money in. But, Jack, you again?
Right, well, I agree and don't agree with what Comrade here said. One, much of the world, I think, is peasant farmers, as we call them, or people working the land for their families, earning outside the so-called Western world or developed countries. In the developed countries, we have 5, 6, possibly 7 supermarkets. We all know who they are, the names of them. At the top of that chain is a family or a single person who has accumulated everything we need to live. That is a capitalist, without a doubt. Whoever owns the... Well, we all know this.
No.
The media, land, you know, everything we need is owned by a handful of people.
If you're free access to it, you can use a lot of the overground.
So when my comrade said here that much of the people don't work for big organisations, in the Western world we most certainly do. We're in the call firms, the communications set up. They might be broken up or something, and Adam will correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, I disagree with that. In the Western world we're all roped into this nonsense, and we're told it's choice. 5 supermarkets, a couple of railway firms. At the top of that is capitalists. The newspapers we read, either online or thing, owned by the...
Well, funny, you know, give a different point of view.
What would you say to that, please, Adam?
Sorry, I was distracted.
You wasn't listening to Jacqueline.
No, I was distracted, but I will comment on it. I see our friend here has come in and copying these things down. I should explain to you. I didn't explain what they were. I just put them there as an illustration of what's said in one part of the book. But if you want to know what they are, this one is the share of profits in national income. This one here, and that's the rate of the rate of return on capital. And this other one is what the economic economists call the capital income ratio, which is it's the amount of wealth that there is divided by the national income. So it says, you know, it's a measure, if you like, of how many times the absolute amount of wealth in existence is times the national income. Anyway, that's that formula. In fact, I could show you if you wanted to. It's the same as the formula Marx has, but a different way around, if I can find the...
Yeah, you might photocopy these notes.
Yeah, but this I didn't deliberately explain what this was. I just put it up here as a sort of, well, not as a sort of joke, but this is the important thing that Piketty says, that wherever the rate of growth, sorry, not the rate of growth, the rate of return on capital is greater than the rate of growth, then inequality will grow. That's the basic argument. Yeah. I mean, these other things, I mean, they all make sense. This one here is the amount of profit that is accumulated, and this is, that's the rate of growth. They all work out if you want to put it down and can be demonstrated. But I mean, they're just formula. You know, they can vary for various different reasons. But anyway, this is the main one that he's talking about. Sorry about that. But I noticed our friends are copying all these things down, and we hadn't explained what they were.
Anybody else?
One critique of Marx, and I haven't got into my head about it, was he mentions it in the book,
yeah.
But I didn't understand it. One critique of Marx is that he was wrong about his central prediction.
What would you name the book? What would you name the book that Marx wrote?
Das Kapital.
Yeah, but he then wrote an apology for it or something like that.
I don't know.
Allow him to ask his question. You must allow the speakers to ask their question.
Of course. I don't know what my question is. So people critique Marx and saying he predicted such and such that capital.
Which is a key topic.
Continually diminish or something. That was proven incorrect because he didn't take into account productivity, technology advancement. Surely Piketty, and this is where I can't quite, I think it's right, but I can't quite get it right in my head. Surely Piketty is saying Marx was right. It was just that there was a period between 1920 and 1970 where capital was, as you said, exogenously destroyed. And we're now back in the normal run of things. So Marx was right. Is that what Piketty is saying, or is that what...
Not quite. I mean, I think Piketty has read parts of Marx, but he interprets, you know, Marx has this theory of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. And Piketty interprets this literally, that it will go on falling till at some point it'll reach towards zero and the capitalist system will collapse, which of course wasn't what Marxists were saying. But so Piketty is refuting an argument which Marx didn't actually put. But on the other hand, well, I think, you know, Marx probably did expect in the very long term the rate of profit to fall, but in between it goes up and down, depending on all sorts of circumstances. But, of course, Piketty is almost putting the opposite theory to what Marx... It wasn't just Marx, incidentally, that was arguing that the rate of profit was going to fall towards zero. Adam Smith did, Ricardo did, Keynes did.
Yeah.
But he's saying the opposite. He's almost saying that there's a tendency for the rate of profit to rise.
Or the rate of capital accumulation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you can take your pick. Either way, whether the rate of profit is falling or rising, capitalism isn't a satisfactory... No, but I reread... There's a whole section here, about three or four pages on that. I read it three or four times to try to understand what he was getting at, because you can't accuse Marx of ignoring increases in productivity, because his whole theory as to why there would be a tendency of the rate of profit to fall was based on the fact that productivity did increase because there was an increasing use of machines and so on, which profit originates only from the part the workers do and not from machines, and therefore there'll be a mathematical tendency to happen. So it's a peculiar definition of the word productivity. But he obviously has read parts of Marx, because he actually quotes from value, price and profit, and he says the figures in there, which I have... This famous capital income ratio there—it's hugely high. You know, it's 50% goes to 50% of it of the national income goes to capital, but it doesn't. It's only about 20 to 30% in practice. But I mean, Marx is only using an example of one particular factory. I mean, most of income, national income, is in fact consumed by workers to reproduce their ability to work. The portion that goes to profits is, as I say, about between 10 and 15%, sometimes more. In fact, that's what drives the capitalist economy. I mean, that 10, 15, 20%, as that goes up and down, it determines whether the economy is in a boom or a slump, you know.
Huh?
Yeah, to comment on what
Jeff
said about most workers not working for the large companies, and I'm not really quite sure what point he was making, but the small companies are all part of the picture, that the majority of people need to work, some work for big companies and some for small, and what the government has sort of been hoping that enough small companies will start up and grow bigger and help with, you know, employing other people. And of course, what happens, a few of them do that. Mostly they don't do that. And I think there's a very large proportion of those people who are now counted as being in employment, I think 40% or more, have become self-employed, and a lot of them are struggling, you know, obviously on very small, getting on very small incomes, but they're all part of the picture of the people who need to work, and don't alter the fact that the minority capitalist class lives off what the majority produces, and I know that Frank won't disagree with this, that it's equally in the interest of those working for whatever kind of company. Capitalism has to go, and it's in everyone's interest to abolish this system and have production solely for use, and cooperating all the energies and so on of the people who have run small companies, whatever, to go into to running society on everyone's behalf, and producing simply to fulfil needs, not producing for sale and profit, producing solely for use. That's the point of it.
Kevin?
Does anyone want to ask a
question? Well, just to make the general point, most of these small employers won't be in the top 1%. They might not even be in the top 5%, but they'll be in the top 10%. Not necessarily in the sense that some of them could have borrowed money in order to set up the business. So that once they take into account their net wealth, they might well not be even in the top 10%, but they might get there eventually. As for the self-employed, most of them are probably worse off than employed workers, because they haven't got regular income coming in. So, I mean, that's a statistical illusion. Most of the self-employed are, in fact, you know, workers that were got particular different legal status.
I read the online newspaper on a regular basis, because it's cheap and it's got what I need to. And what I've sort of been picking up from the various political commentary in there is that with this sort of big austerity movement that's been going on for quite a while now, it's given some aspects of the government the opportunity to close down as much of state provision as they can, so the benefit cuts. All the sort of things provided by the state have been pulled back, so the private industry can come and move in. But traditional areas of employment are not taking in people now anymore, not so much. So there's been pressure on people to do part-time jobs or to set their own sort of process. Now, as the lady said, a lot of these people, a lot of these people are not actually getting a lot of money for what they do. And in a sense, I might argue that the economy's been sort of fragmented a bit more. A complete withdrawal, as much as they can get away with state provision. The private sector hasn't really solved it, and so people have been forced to try and negotiate their own ways of living. And it's not always been very profitable for them either. there's been a sort of a change in how things have been produced in the country. But you know, the idea that at the moment we're on an economic revival, I think, is a very shallow point of view to adopt.
I think coping with the
Okay. Do you want to respond to any last few?
No, I agree with that. But yeah. I can do something else while I'm here. I did say that this would be translated into Marxist economic terms. So, is this what Piketty calls the first fundamental law of capital? That's how he expresses it. Now, this is the share of profits in national income. So, it's, in Marxist terms, it's S. That's the income of the capitalist, that's the income of the worker, right? So this one here, R, is the rate of return on capital, so that's sort of C. And this one, this beta, is, well, in fact, it's capital income ratio I was talking about, so it's I was getting this right. That's the total amount of capital, amount of wealth in existence, divided by the national income. So I mean, this is capital income ratio is how many times more the total amount of capital is than the national income. It's about 4 or 5. Now, if you want to calculate what the rate of profit is, which is this, people got all their algebra. So that's the rate of profit. So these two cancel out. And the rate of profit equals the rate of profit. So in fact, it should be that actually in mathematical terms. But anyway, so if you wanted to, you can express these things in the same category as Mark. You can do the same with the other one, but it's more complicated. It takes into account. Well, it's a bit like the end of Volume 2 of Capital, actually, where he works out what percentage of profits is reinvested and what percentage is consumed by the capitalist class. But anyway, the former isn't wrong, just expressed in a different way from Marx, but it works.
That's an exploration made for radios.
Anybody else want to ask any questions or make any comments?
No, I just mentioned that because I saw two people making notes. Is it so? Mm.
Oh. I can have a copy of the book today, Anna.
Just to let everybody know, a collection of £30.71. Thank you very much. Well, next talk, I think I've already advertised it, is the case against fracking on the 23rd of November. There's a leaflet going about.
Don't misunderstand that term, Jack.
I don't.
All right, good.
I think that's it, really, is it?
One question.
Yeah, Jacqueline?
Just to recap, you're saying that Piketty, his book Capital, it's the third part that is of interest to us international socialists.
The third part, I mean, the second part is all this, you know.
Right.
Which is interesting if you're interested in that sort of thing. The third part is, well, I'll give you the headings of the chapters. Because, you know, I've been concentrating on the inequality in the distribution of wealth. He goes in as well to the inequality in the distribution of income. But, I mean, as far as we as socialists are concerned, it's the more important one is the inequality in wealth, not income. In fact, inequality of income more or less follows from inequality of wealth, because the income of the top 1% of people is mostly income from property. But he does he claims that the one factor in the increase in inequality of income is these super salaries of the super managers, which of course aren't really salaries, their way of sharing out, Sir Peter didn't say that incidentally, but they're a way of sharing out surplus value, a bit like in Russia they did it in bloated society. It's a tax thing.
I was about to ask you, you know, these large sellers that have played, do you regard that as part of surplus value, or is surplus value an action?
What would happen?
Saving far more than they.
If you put a big tax on, you tax, say, the top part of some of these super salaries at 80%, 90%, and so on, would be they'd find a way around it of making it appear as some other form of income. Because I can remember in the 60s and 70s that I think unearned income, as it was called on the tax form that I filled out, was taxed at a much higher rate than earned income. So in that case, the people disguise the unearned income as a salary. They've got all these tax laws to get around these things. Quite apart from quite apart from the fact it's not going to happen anyway. So,
but I was pleased that you concentrated, if I may say so, more on income than wealth.
No, wealth and income, you mean?
Yeah, but I think you said you was looking at income. Did you not say you're looking at income more than the...
No, I said I was looking at wealth more than income.
Exactly. I got it wrong. Well
because, no,
I'm
a bit
out of it now because I've got income, but I haven't got wealth.
Oh, sorry, to ruin your joke halfway through.
Yeah. I didn't know. Did you ever know
that? That 50%, Alan, that you referred to in this bottom half, they, I think, are defined in his book as those without any assets.
Yeah.
No wealth. Zero wealth.
Yeah.
Well, so when he looks at the distribution of wealth, there's a half of society that has none.
Yeah, I mean, the figures he gives, well, is the bottom 50% own about 3-5% of total wealth. And he says the highest it's ever reached in any country is in Sweden, where it once reached 10%. But I mean, even in Sweden now, today, which is supposed to be the most equal country in the world, and it's still the figures the top 10% own 60% or something like that, which is that's the most equal country in the world, and that's still a high degree of inequality.
But the assets fund's a bit difficult, really, isn't it? Because some people say, I own my own house, right?
Yeah.
What they're meaning is if they're not paid their last payment, they're paying a mortgage.
Yeah.
And that asset is not their asset until they pay for it.
I know, but
and if they have to leave that place, they've got to buy somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. But, all this is taken into account in the statistic, because it's like our friend here said, it's the net wealth. I mean, most people a lot of people in the country have got negative wealth, precisely for the reason that you're talking about. But he also makes the point, which is interesting, that in countries like America and Britain and France, the national debt and the state's assets, they more or less balance each other out. So what, in fact, they're doing by sort of state directly owning things is they're paying interest to people that have lent lent the government money rather than paying it to people on benefits. But in this thing here, they have Len McCluskey, the trade union leader, and he says we should have a capital levy, a wealth tax, to pay off the national debt. Well, there'll be some capitalists who'll be quite happy with that, because you just transfer money from one section of the capitalist class to another. The people that own the national debt, which is owned by capitalists, so it'll just be a transfer of property from one to the other.
Jackie, Adam, it's a bit off what you're talking, but it's I just want to get the Marxist view on pensions. What is pensions? Because is that dead surplus value? I only know those three terms, having read the monthly journal of the Socialist Party, Socialist Standard, and I don't quite understand what happens there. Or could you give me that answer?
You can look at it two ways. Some people, trade unionists and so on, look at the pension as a deferred wage. But on the other hand, it comes out of, surplus value in the end, doesn't it? I mean, the state taxes capitalists and uses part of the money to pay pensions. So obviously,
there's a lot of contributory pensions around.
Yeah.
No, it gets complicated.
Well, it gets even more complicated if you bring in pension funds. Who owns the pension funds and how much wealth do they own, and so on and so forth. But it's there are all sort of arguments that can go on as to what is a pension. I agree that even amongst people who call themselves Marxian economics, I mean, we did an interview in the Socialist Standard with a man called Andrew Keemer, and he claims that the rate of profit has been stable or going down in the last 50 or so years. Other people claim it's been, well, like he does, but it's been going up. But it all depends on how you work out what the compensation of workers is. If you just include their money wages or their after-tax wages, the standard of living workers has gone down, although the proportion of national income that goes as compensation for workers has gone down. But if you include pensions and other benefits, if there's transfer payments which are made to workers, then it hasn't happened. And it makes a difference to how you calculate the rate of profit. You know? So there are all sorts of arguments which they can go on, even amongst people who are Marxian economists and socialists about it. But I personally can't see how you can say that pensions really are a deferred wage. But, I know the trade unions use. I've been a trade unionist and use this argument. I'm not convinced that it's. But anyway, if they want to pay us pensions, where they get them from, I don't mind.
Guys from the hard working industries of the post office and British Telecom. I mean,
well, you know, you and me are in civil service pension schemes, so it's run on a pay as you go scheme. So we're being paid out of the contributions of the current people who are working.
And the public sector, of course.
Yeah, what's in trouble?
Anybody else?
I'd like to hear more of these words to say on another occasion. What is written? Who knows?
What is written? There you are. The Socialist Standard for Scottish referendum.
I mean, you can come upstairs and have a cup of tea or coffee and talk to the speaker.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Is that it then? Yeah? Yeah, thank you, Adam. Thanks, Adam.